Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Make sure not to miss a single podcast and subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite subscription service. The views expressed in this presentation are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Army, or Department of Defense.
Hello, and welcome to A Better Peace. I'm Carrie Lee, Chair of the Department of National Security and Strategy and Director of the Civil Military Relations Center here at the U.S. Army War College. I'm your host for our special series that focuses on today's debates and discussions in civil-military relations. The U.S. military today is in a period of transition and transformation as it moves from two decades of conflict in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism to preparing for great power competition with China. At the same time, it is faced with major societal divisions that ask military leaders to navigate an increasingly complex recruiting environment and revamp its personnel system to revitalize talent management in a competitive labor market. All of these lead today's military to deal with questions of identity. What is the purpose of the military? Who should be serving to best prepare the force for the fight of the future? Who counts as a member of the profession of arms? Yet these are not new questions. We are joined today by Dr. David Fitzgerald of the University College of Cork and recent author of the book Uncertain Warriors, The United States Army Between the Cold War and the War on Terror, published last year by Cambridge University Press. Dr. Fitzgerald is an historian of the United States and the world, American military history, and the ways in which wars reverberate in American society and culture. He completed his PhD in 2010 at the University College of Cork and also served as a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for American Studies at the University College Dublin. He has published four books on American military institutions and strategy that cover topics from counterinsurgency doctrine to foreign policy under Obama to American grand strategy after World War II. Dr. Fitzgerald, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to start by asking kind of a broad question. What caused you to really choose to write this book, looking at the United States Army kind of immediately after the Cold War and this period of the 1990s that, in my read, doesn't get a lot of attention in kind of American military history?
Sure. I think it was probably prompted by my first book. So my first book was on counterinsurgency doctrine after the Vietnam War, and looking at how the Army kind of rethought counterinsurgency and rethought the lessons of Vietnam in kind of a fairly tangled up way. And part of that project was reading student papers from War College students. That's part of the that's a great source, I have to say. But also reading professional journals, right? So reading Military Review, reading Parameters, and what I kind of found odd when I was reading material from the 1990s, right? So if you think back to maybe 91, 92, this is a moment of triumph, right? This is when the Gulf War has been won, the Cold War is over. If you look at opinion polling, I'm sure you know this better than I, the Army's reputation, the military's reputation is just astronomically high. This is an extraordinary good time to be a soldier. And yet, if you read the journals, if you read like Military Review, you'll find a lot of really angsty articles in there. You'll find people who are a bit worried about the future, who are not that confident that they're in the sunlit uplands of the unipolar moment or the end of history. And I kind of found that tension really interesting, right? Between this moment of, like, on the one hand, triumph and reputational zenith in a way, and then on the other hand this anxiety that I kind of picked up in these journals, and then I wanted to take it a little bit further and kind of said, yeah, there might be something there may be a book in this. It did take me probably a couple of years to realize it was a book, if that makes sense, but once I dug into the material, it was just really rich.
So what are the challenges that are causing all of this angst in the force at the end of the 1980s and early 1990s?
So I would say two things. One is geopolitical. And then I do think there's a social cultural element as well. So the first part in terms of geopolitics is the Army in particular, by the late 1980s, I would say was very well engineered to fight the Cold War, to, you know, send forces over to Germany, to fight in the Fuller Gap, all that sort of stuff we all know about. And I do think that absent that Soviet threat, absent that sort of North Star, I think a lot of people were uncertain about where to go. And I think that's particularly difficult for the Army in this period, because you look at, say, the Air Force or the Navy, you know, they had a good Desert Storm too, right? A very good one. And they saw their future in terms of high-tech war and servicing targets and precision, you know, precision munitions. The Marines have always been pretty adaptable. They've always done expeditionary warfare. They've always done these sort of operations. And the Army is a bit different in that sense. And I think that was a struggle for many officers, many senior leaders to say, okay, well, in this new world, what do we do? What future, you know, missions are we going to look at? And then, as I said, the second part of this is much more social, cultural. And that is a sense where you've this sort of another paradox where the Army is, and the military in general, is this sort of symbol of what's right with America, right? In all sorts of ways in the early 1990s. And yet there's this gap that's already been there, but it's beginning to widen in the 1990s between the Army and broader American society. And that has knock-on effects in terms of recruiting, in terms of controversy around sexuality and gender, and in terms of questions of who should serve in the military. And I think those two things together produce this kind of very strange crisis of sort of anxiety in the Army at the time.
So your introduction and that first chapter of the book really focuses on kind of the legacy of the Vietnam War and thinking through... you know, you have a period of time in the 1970s where you switched to the all-volunteer force, the kind of infamous statement about the Hollow Army in 1979 and testimony in 1980, and the ways in which Vietnam kind of impacts the way that the Army sees itself and drives it to this preparation and rising defense budgets in the 80s and whatnot. What were the short and long-term consequences of the Vietnam War on the Army as we kind of look going forward?
So I think, you know, the major consequence is something that kicks off in the early to mid 70s when you have this huge sort of step change in terms of how the Army has decided it really does not like counterinsurgency anymore. It really doesn't want to do this form of war. And under Bill Depew and Tradoc, they begin to focus very much back on that, the war, the potential war with the Soviet Union, with the kind of conventional operations that they were quite comfortable with. So there's that refocusing, and that of course brings with the doctrine, it brings with the weapon systems, which really does reorient the Army back to something that was much more traditional. And then I also think, I don't think directly a result of Vietnam, but of course the all-volunteer force is coming out of the Vietnam era as well in terms of the debates over the draft. And obviously that is a huge change for the Army to be a peacetime, large-scale, all-recruited force is quite an unusual thing, I think, in broader American military history. I think those two things together, I think, produce a really different force.
Now, at least on the geopolitical side, I can't help but draw parallels to what's going on today, right? We have two decades of counterinsurgency. The Army, in a lot of ways, is saying, wow, that really sucked, and we're not going to do that. We're reorienting towards competition with People's Republic of China, with what's going on in Europe and Ukraine right now. A lot of focus on, you know, countering threats in Eastern Europe and in the Indo-Pacific, and a desire to move past Iraq and Afghanistan towards bigger competition. But at the same time, when you think about, I guess the term used to be air-sea battle, right? The Army isn't there. And so where are you seeing kind of similar parallels? What's different today? What's similar today compared to kind of where the Army found itself after Vietnam?
Sure. So I think there are quite a few parallels. Obviously, as you said, you outlined them very well in terms of this desire to move away from a form of warfare that the Army really did not like. But I do think the differences are worth pointing out too, because we can get kind of, you know, I'm a historian and historians always think in terms of, you know, historical analogies and historical lessons. And we're also, as historians, we're always very particular about, no, this thing is not like that other thing. This is a different time. So what's different, I think, is one, I do think the Army in the 1970s was in a much worse state, right? Just in terms of the recruiting crisis was deeper. Disciplinary issues were worse. The equipment probably was worse. So there's that. And the other thing, I'm a little bit undecided about myself, but I do think often of a memo that Don Starry, who was Depew's successor, Tradoc, sent, where he was kind of asked about, I think maybe this is maybe 79 or thereabouts, and he was asked, like, why are you moving away from counterinsurgency? What are the probabilities here? What are the probabilities we're going to be asked to do this sort of fighting again? He said, well, you know, we do think that in terms of, you know, probabilities of it happening, we think war in northwest Europe is actually relatively less likely, actually, than going back to counterinsurgency wars. But he said, in terms of risk for us, it's much greater. That losing that war is much more serious for us. And I wonder about that sort of, are we in the similar moment today in terms of trade-off senior leaders are trying to make about, you know, what matters. And as someone who's not American, the notion the American military has limited resources seems bizarre to me, but I do recognize if you're working in the Pentagon, you don't feel that way. And there are choices to be made. So yeah, this might be a bit of a roundabout answer, but I do think of that Don Starry memo a lot, actually, in terms of he's saying, look, one is likely, one is more dangerous, and this is where we're going to make this choice.
No, that's an interesting way to phrase it. I'll oftentimes tell my students, right, if we do our jobs right, we will only be involved in peripheral conflicts because we will have deterred the catastrophic one.
Sure.
And so that's an interesting trade-off that you have to make. But your story really starts with kind of post-Desert Storm, right? There's all this lead up to, yes, the impact of Vietnam, but we enter the New World Order, so to speak, in 1990, 1991 in post-Desert Storm. You know, my mother was a public affairs officer for the Air Force during this time. And so we relocated as a family to Florida during Desert Shield and Desert Storm so that she could work public affairs. And so my image of post-Desert Storm is all ticker tape parades and, you know, big homecoming ceremonies and Lee Greenwood with God Bless the USA. And, you know, this is my kind of memory. Why would we even think that there's a problem societally, I guess? Like, is there any kind of social sense that, oh, we need to really revamp the military? Because my memory of this, you know, apart from the institutional, what's being written in the pages of Parameters, is like, hey, rah, rah, this is great. Let us be on top of the world.
Sure. I think you're absolutely right. One of my favorite sort of statistics or anecdotes or pieces of data from this is that the parades lasted longer than the war. The parades start in March. I think the last major parades are like August or September, right? So you're not wrong to think about the ticker tape parades as being important. And then that's absolutely true. I guess, you know, in terms of public perception, you would have to peer pretty hard to find those first murmurings of discontent, right? Because this is, you know, a moment of absolute, you know, public unity. It doesn't last very long, but these parades are massive. You know, you've got, you know, many people in New York City turning up for these parades. You've got this, you know, months-long celebration that's all the summer of 1991. But if you want to look for a discontent, and it's there, right? I don't want to exaggerate. I don't want to pretend that, like, oh, if only you just peer under the rock, you would find all this discontent. One moment, and it's a very minor one, but it does kind of point towards what's to come in a year or two, is the historian and journalist Randy Schiltz has got a great book called Conduct Unbecoming, which is about the history of homosexuality in the US military. And in his latter chapters, he kind of touches on the early 90s. And he talks about how Desert Storm veterans were wearing their uniforms and pride parades. Now, many of them have been discharged at this point in time. So you can see sort of this, they've been discharged for homosexuality after Desert Storm, not before, because the military needed them. So you can see these moments of like, well, there are these, and this sounds very conspiratorial, but there are various groups in society who say, okay, well, we've been excluded from the military, from military service. And this moment of time, that is an infringement on our rights because, you know, military service is something, the making of a citizen. It has all these educational benefits, all these different benefits. And you do see, I think, around the Desert Storm, those groups sort of begin to say, well, what about us? And where do we fit into this? 1991, it's there only marginally. But you can even think about the Navy. I'm jumping services here. The Tehalik scandal is 1991. Right, so this is the first major crisis of the decade in terms of sexual assault, sexual harassment, all these sort of issues begin. So they begin to come pretty thick and quick. And I think that memory you have is very real, but it does dissipate much more quickly than people thought it would, if that makes sense.
Can you talk a little bit about the election of Bill Clinton to the presidency and then, you know, commander in chief of the military? This is the first person who's elected who's like not a Vietnam veteran, takes a lot of flack for that. It sparks what I like to think of as the origins of people in my community who wring their hands about civil military relations crises.
Sure.
And so we get the first set of like articles in the 1990s about crises in civil military relations in the United States. You know, what does that really mean, the kind of tension between Clinton and Powell and how that's playing out?
I do think it's important. And I think those first generation articles are pretty useful, actually. I think they still hold up, I think, a lot of them. You know, in some sense, you can see this, you can say, oh, this is kind of silly, this stuff about, I'm sure you're familiar with it, you know, Clinton couldn't salute properly and he had to be trained to do that. And it's very image-based. But I think the Powell-Clinton relationship is really interesting because, you know, Powell has a certain vision for how he sees, you know, how he thinks US grand strategy, when he used that word, should go, and how the military should be employed, and who the military is, actually. And he does clash with Clinton pretty quickly. And I think the issue, obviously, that I think is quite consequential in Clinton's early days is obviously is due to homosexuality. And Powell here plays, I would say, if I can use the term, quite a negative role here, in terms of he's enough of a diplomat to, in terms of grand strategy stuff, to say, look, you know, he has disagreements with Clinton on forced deployment and what have you. But on issues of homosexuality, he comes out very strongly in the transition, actually. So not even when Clinton's president, to say that, you know, he's not comfortable with the idea of gay military members being able to serve openly. And that, you know, causes huge problems and tensions. And the Clinton transition team are scrambling to do something about this and to meet the Joint Chiefs and get a sense of how they're going to push this policy forward. And then in terms of the public conversation, where Powell, I think, really is destructive, or certainly is very destructive of Clinton's agenda, is one of the analogies people were using, I would think it's a reasonable analogy, is to do with civil rights. Say, you know, why should an African-American be able to serve? If an African-American can serve, surely a gay man or woman should be able to serve too. This is a simple issue of civil rights. And Powell says, well, as a black service member, I disagree with that. Mm-hmm. And I think one is about skin pigment and one is about human behaviour. And that really is a moment, I think, where really that is very difficult. And that puts Clinton in the very early weeks of his presidency in a very difficult place that I don't think he ever really fully got out of. I don't over egg, don't ask, don't tell, and that whole debate. But I do think that puts Clinton in a particular position with the military. And I would say Powell, of all the various service chiefs and senior figures, is the one that causes him the most difficulty. Even he's not the most vehement in terms of his opposition, it's just the way he articulates it and the public forum he has does create serious problems for Clinton.
Yeah. It's not just a question in the 1990s of who gets to serve, though, right? It's like, what do we use service members for as well?
Sure.
So can you talk a little bit about that conflict that happens over the course of the 90s?
Yeah. So this, I suppose, is going back to the geopolitical question, right? So, well, what missions do we have, right? What are we here to do? What do we need our soldiers to do? What's useful for them to do? And of course, one of the major missions, or one of the major sort of series of missions in the 1990s, is peacekeeping missions. And it's not, doesn't start under Clinton, it starts under Bush, it continues under Clinton. And, you know, if you were a military service member in the 1990s, your deployment was most likely going to be peacekeeping to, you know, Haiti, to Bosnia, to Kosovo, to Somalia. And those missions require something a bit different, right? They require service members to behave differently. They require, I think, a little bit of a different ethos in a sense. And there is an interesting debate, I think, within the military about that, and the sense of, on the one hand, you have a lot of, I would say a lot of retired figures, but also some senior figures within the military who say, well, what we need to do in the Army is we need to be more like the Marines. We need to gender segregate basic training, get back to the old way of doing things. It should be about toughness, should be about a certain form of masculinity. It should be about being warriors, right? This is what we need to train in, this is what we need to do. And then others say, well, that mindset is not particularly useful on a checkpoint in Tuzla. That isn't going to go over very well. And you need a softer skill set and a different skill set. And that gets wrapped up with questions of gender in particular. The sociologists Charles Moskos and Laura Miller, they do a really interesting study. I think it's in Operation Restore Hope, where they interview about 800 odd peacekeepers in Somalia, and they ask them about their attitudes towards the locals and towards the mission and whatever else. And they really find this interesting breakdown. One is that the infantry tend to be hyper-aggressive, which is not that surprising, I guess, and have a very disdainful attitude towards locals, support troops less so. But then what's interesting is there's also a racial and gender breakdown, that women tended to be less aggressive. And I mean this, you know, and we should always think in the military, think of aggression as an adaptive behavior. It's not always an adaptive behavior, right? It can be maladaptive. and I suppose maybe it's to do the context of Mali, but African-American soldiers were also actually much less aggressive in their operation. So in a sense, then there becomes this utilitarian argument. Well, we need a different sort of soldier. We need a different sort of mindset. And actually opening up, you know, the ranks is not just sort of a sop to the politicians. It's operationally useful for us.
It's also occurring during a time of technological transformation that relies more on precision weapons and, you know, more precise operations that don't necessarily perhaps require the level of brawn or physical strength. Is that a fair thing to say?
No, I think that's true. I think that's broadly true. I will say I think the army are a bit more conflicted about this stuff than the other services. Like I mentioned earlier on, the Navy and the Air Force loved precision, you know, precision munitions and everything to do with it. And the army's doubts about this weren't about brawn. They weren't about, well, actually, what happens to our manly big soldiers if we have all these precision weapons? It was to do with a broader philosophical sense of like, well, servicing targets isn't a strategy, right? So I think there was something interesting going on with the ranks of the army. But yeah, there is definitely a move towards, you know, networked operations, a whole suite of new weapons systems that come in. That, yeah, generally speaking, they do require less or can require less physical brawn. And one of the issues the army has actually is there is a recruiting crisis in the 1990s. At the same time, the army is investing heavily in new systems, networks and command and control systems. And they need a lot of technicians to service them, like a lot. And they cannot retain them. Retention is really difficult. And the Army Science Board kind of come up with the various studies saying, look, why don't you offer more bonuses? Why do we make every single cadet at West Point major in STEM, actually, you know, go back to the old days engineering.
Boy, these debates sound familiar.
Right. and they're it's a struggle. And they talk about, what do they call it? Cyber warriors. They went to cyber warriors. Uh-huh. And that was a problem for them. The ultimate solution wasn't retention. It was contractors. That's what they ended up with, which produces a different form of identity too, right? If the contractor's in the mission and they're in the unit, they're civilian, but they're there with you on the mission, that produces, I think, an interesting hybrid identity as well.
So going back again to the peacekeeping idea, you know, the quote that sticks in my mind that I think a lot of people are very familiar with that involves both kind of civil military discord, but also kind of gendered discord, comes from Madeleine Albright, right? What's the purpose of having a big military if you can't use it? So can you talk a little bit about kind of where the high level civil military conflict is happening when the army is engaging in these peacekeeping missions? It's finding that it requires different skill sets that privilege things like emotional intelligence and other things that women may be stronger in. You know, where does this conflict really play out?
It's interesting. On the Madeleine Albright quote, I think, Powell's memoirs, he said, what's the phrase? He said, I screamed internally when I heard that. So it definitely resonated in all sorts of serious ways. So look, obviously, at the very high level, at the national command level, there's obviously Powell in particular, and then his successor, John Shalikashvili, really don't want to do these missions. Like, they just don't want to do them. They're not interested. But at the same time, you know, as you as a scholar of civil military relations know better than I, you just have to salute and do your job sometimes, right? And there are other reasons why these missions are important for various reasons. And Powell, I suppose, you know, exits the scene relatively early, right? So he's not there for the duration. He's there as a critic on the sidelines. But Shalikashvili is interesting. You know, he says, you know, we should not be doing these missions. We should, or if we do them, we should do them, get in, get out, give it to our partners and whatever else. But within the army, at least, when it kind of gets down to that level, within the army staff, I do think you see an acceptance of like, okay, we don't like it, but we're going to have to do them. And I think that there is an acceptance throughout the decade that, okay, look, we're being sent to these missions. And then there's also, I think, you know, I don't want to paint the army as uniformly hostile. Some people are saying, well, this gives us something, to, you know, useful to do. We can do this. You know, we can learn how to do this. And why not learn how to do it? This is a mission. That's a real mission that we have, in a way that, you know, pretending that the Soviet Union still exists isn't a real mission. So, there is that. And then the lower down you go in the ranks, you'll find people who say, well, you know what, I get to go overseas, I get to do some patrols, I get to do some checkpoints. this is interesting work to me. So it's actually not quite as black and white as you might think. So then within the ranks, you do find people saying, yeah, this is interesting. This is worthwhile work. But as you said, it does come then with different challenges in terms of readiness. And if you look at the Army's training performance, you know, that's obviously the big thing you need to do is to train people to do these missions. It can vary a lot in terms of how well trained units are. Some went to Germany and they did a very, you know, complex series of exercises at the corps level and division level before they went to Bosnia, and it seemed very impressive. Others, I'll never forget one unit, a battalion were sent to Macedonia and they were based in Germany. They had 2 weeks notice for the deployment, but yet they did not stop rehearsals for the 4th of July parade, which seemed more important to them. You know, and that unit did not perform very well once it got over there, right? So, you know, I think in terms of the training piece, sometimes that's where I think you can look at that and say, okay, well, where's the attention being paid? And again, it varied. Sometimes it was good. Sometimes it wasn't great. They would go to, say, GRTC in Fort Polk, which it was called at the time. And, you know, that was supposed to be kind of peacekeeping related, but every commander got to write their own exercise a little bit, and they'd say, okay, at the end though, big battle, right? Big battle. So, you know, that was where the focus ended up being inevitably.
So, I mean, it sounds like the 90s were this time of actually immense change in the military. You have the rise of contractors. Women are accepted into becoming fighter pilots in 1993. The rise of new technologies, a different type of mission set in peacekeeping, recruiting challenges throughout the 1990s, the implementation of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and subsequent debates about homosexuality in the military, big changes. And the argument that you make, or what you find, is that the solution to this becomes a warrior ethos. Can you talk about a little bit about, like, what is the warrior ethos and why was this the solution to the problems of the 1990s?
Yeah, so I think this comes out, I think, towards the end of the decade. You see the beginnings of it, and then it gets implemented into doctrine in 2003. So it gets implemented, it becomes doctrinal in the fullest sense after the 1990s, but I do see it very much as a product of that. So on the one hand, the solution, you know, in terms of the big picture stuff outside of identity, like force structure, doctrine, is kind of punting a little bit, right? So the army doesn't restructure itself. It's like a smaller Cold War army in that sense, right? And senior leadership says, well, we can do everything. We can do peacekeeping. We're good at that. We're the best soldiers in the world. We've got the training to do that. But then you sort of have, on the one hand, people saying, well, this doesn't seem very military to me. I'm not really much of a fan of this. This is not what I signed up for. And there's all sorts of gendered language around peacekeeping and those operations. And there's discontent there. There's also, on the political side of this, in terms of domestic politics, because of these various controversies over sexuality and gender, the army in particular are seen as kind of, on the conservative side of things, they're seen as they're weak, they're giving it to Clinton, they're just doing what they're told. There's a very toxic atmosphere around them. And then I think what happens really is with the warrior ethos, it comes out of special forces, I think. So the first time I found it mentioned in doctrine, special forces doctrine, about 1988, and it says, well, all special forces soldiers have a warrior ethos. They have this way of doing things. And what that does basically is says soldiers are different. That's essentially what it means, right? There's interesting conversations around the warrior ethos where you have, of course, army values. Those are really important, right? And those get reemphased after the Aberdeen Proving Ground scandals, various sexual assault scandals. Chief Staff of the Army says, we got to go back to values. And that's really important. And they push out all these training videos and materials around that. And that's all important. And then someone says, well, army values, you just read them. It just means being a good person. Right? It just means being, you know, being a good American. And they said, well, what makes us different? Well, the warrior ethos makes us different. It's about self-sacrifice. It's about the willingness to do violence and whatever else. And that becomes, I think, a way for the army to sort of elide the debate a little bit by saying, well, you know, we can use the warrior ethos for anything. We can use it for peacekeeping because these are self-sacrificing warriors. And it's actually a bit vague. If you read doctrine on it, it's not, you know, it's pretty short. The warrior ethos is a pretty short document. And, you know, that gets them out of a couple of different jams in the sense that it allows them to say, well, we're still traditional and tough. But we do these new things as well, and that's fine. But what it gets read as outside of doctrine is something much more aggressive. It's actually read in cultural context. It's read as, you know, operator culture, you know, blasting down doors, close quarter combat, and that's what it becomes to mean. And becomes, and again, and more it's sort of reified in pop culture and within doctrine as well. I think it serves to say the military is different. We are different from everyone else. We do something no one else does, and that's the real emphasis of the war ethos, which then leads us, I suppose, to jump forward decades. It leads us to, I think, various crises then, right?
That's so interesting to me that it gets that the doctrine gets read differently in the public sphere. Why is there such an appetite? Why is that fertile ground to sort of misinterpret or take the kernels in doctrine and then really run with it in popular culture and American society?
That's a great question. I need to, so I'm going to think out loud with this answer, right?
Yeah.
So I'll do my best. So I think one, I suppose it's important to say that it's not like the general public is reading army leadership doctrine, right? They're not breaking up with the film manual. Oh, interesting, you know, right? But obviously, if you think about how, okay, so if you think about the first instance, right, think of how the war ethos is taught to soldiers. It's taught in basic training, right? You get dog tags, you learn it. So the and it's very simple, you know, I am a warrior is basically the language. And that gets repeated and repeated. And then think, you know, by the time it gets into the force at the junior level, it doesn't necessarily mean what army leadership meant it to mean. And then I think when you get into popular culture, you know, as I said, this comes out doctrinally in 2003. And of course, at this point, the war in Afghanistan is ongoing. The war in Iraq is about to start. So I think it does intersect with later post 9/11 developments, right? In terms of the American military being sent overseas to these very difficult missions. And I think that, I don't want to pretend that what I'm talking about is completely divorced from that. I think it gets tied up in that pretty quickly, I think.
There's a public signaling aspect of it, right? Talk to me about kind of General Shinseki and the Black Berets.
Right. This is one of my favorite stories from the book. I found this tranche of documents in AHEC years ago and just loved it. So Shinseki, yeah, I maybe should have talked this earlier because it's a really good example of what I'm trying to get at. So Shinseki, basically, he's Army Chief of Staff and he takes his up the post and says, right, we need to go for transformation. And he insists on capitalizing transformation. So all army, you know, communications, transformation with the capital T, or what we're doing, we're transitioning to this new force.
Proper noun.
Right, absolutely. We're going to have, you know, obviously you can think of these legacies, the Stryker vehicle. We're going to have these medium weight brigades. We're going to be able to deploy super quickly anywhere in the world. Our new weapon systems will allow us to be very flexible. And he says, well, okay, but to symbolize transformation, we need something to sort of get a mental mind shift in the force. And he has this bright idea, if you want to use a bright or term bright. He says, well, why shouldn't everyone wear berets? Because berets are, you know, these are things that previously special forces only have worn or airborne or these special units. And the idea here is, you know, every American soldier will be, in a sense, unified by this beret. They'll all think of this as part of the same team. And part of this is he had read the Mark Bowden book, Black Hawk Down, which of course then becomes a movie. And in that book, you'll see various sort of fiefdoms, right? So the Delta Force don't get on with the SEALs, don't get on with the Rangers, and all there's all this disunity. And he says at one point, when he's writing a very angry letter to a journalist who's criticizing him, he said, well, I was carried off the battlefield in Vietnam twice and no one cared what colour, you know, what unit they were from. We were all American soldiers together. And that's Shinseki's effort, is to use the beret to symbolise change. And of course, it kicks up just enormous opposition. So one is the 75th Ranger Regiment are, they're already wearing black berets. They're very unhappy about this. And then, you know, this goes on all summer. Various Ranger veterans, this is summer 2001, I should say, various Ranger veterans are getting upset. They're marching to Washington to present the beret of a dead Ranger to the White House. It gets very, very emotional. And eventually he gives them their own new colour, and that gets around it. But it's his notion that these symbols can, the sartorial politics of the army can be important, right? That it can unify people. I don't think the beret thing worked particularly well for him. I'll note the army no longer wears berets. They're uncomfortable. They soak up the water. They don't protect you from the rain. They're not practical pieces of headwear, actually, despite what people in airborne units think. But the war ethos is also his idea, and that one stuck in a way, right? So the berets don't stick, and the war ethos, you know, carried on with successor Pete Shoemaker, but that really does stick and gets out of control in some ways, I think. So it's interesting to think about this, you know, senior leaders and symbolism and what can land and what doesn't land, and then how what lands isn't always under your control anymore.
So I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what about the warrior ethos sticks? What about it? You know, you make the argument that it contributes to a widening civil-military gap because it identifies soldiers as being exceptional and we do these things that other Americans don't do, as opposed to Army values, which I think it was Robert Gates who kind of looked at, walked the halls of the Pentagon and saw, you know, the list of Army values and said, these are just American values, right? So I guess what I'm getting at is some have compared or put a warrior ethos in contrast with a kind of more democratic ethos to the military. Why would you put these two potentially in conversation with one another?
Well, so I think it's the very sort of simplistic way to go about this is, well, what do you mean by warrior? But I do think it's important. And to my mind, I think the reason they're put in opposition so often is warrior is sort of almost primordial identity, right? It's what you do. You are a warrior. You never stop being a warrior. A soldier, you know, serves their country and then stops, right? And they can be a former soldier and they can always have those memories. But the warrior is more existential in that sense, right? That's what's different about it. But I guess the difficulty here is this is what I'm saying, you know, this is why I'm saying it's important to think of what we mean by warrior. I don't know that everyone who uses the phrase warrior thinks about existential issues like that, right? So I think the army, when they use the word warrior, they said, well, we just mean it to be someone who is going to, you know, sacrifice themselves and be willing to inflict violence if needs be, and that's important. But that existential meaning of warrior is, I think, you know, we can use the term warrior caste. Other scholars have used that term quite a lot in terms of civil-military divides. And it does create this identity that is not American, that is different. That is about a brotherhood that is outside of the broader society. So I think that's where the opposition comes in. But I think for the army, the two are in conversation because I don't know that the senior leaders were thinking all the way through about what warrior could mean to people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always struck by the juxtaposition of like a Spartan versus Athenian, right? Mm-hmm. When I think warrior ethos versus democratic ethos. And, you know, we talk a lot about the Peloponnesian War here at the War College. And so, you know, I'm always kind of struck by that conversation. But what I'm hearing you say is that most senior leaders don't see that as stark a divide.
Yeah, I think, and I should say, I there's probably a lot of army units called the Spartans. I don't know how many army units are called the Athenians.
No, I don't think there are.
That'd be really
any,
interesting,
right,
to find that out, right? Yeah, and look, and this is where, I do think, you know, to put yourself in the shoes of army leaders, you know, these are busy people. They work pretty hard. They do a lot of different things. And it's always difficult for me, at least when I'm reading their memos and their documents and the various minutes of meetings, to, you know, for me, these are the most important things in the world. These are so important. These minutes that I'm reading, these memos, these documents, they had a lot of things on their minds. So I don't want to, you know, I do think the warrior ethos is important to take. I do think it matters. I mean, someone wrote this doctrine, there's a whole task force warrior, you know, who came up with this. But I don't know. Yeah, I just need other things to worry about and other things on the horizon. So I don't want to say it's like a historical accident, right? That's far too flippant. But I do think it's worth... I shouldn't say this is my own topic. Like, if you think too hard about it, you know, if you think harder about it than they did, you might, you know, you might impute some meaning that they didn't mean to give. I don't know. That's a little bit speculative, but that's kind of where I land on it.
All right. So I'll ask you to speculate one more time as we kind of careen into the future here. The U.S. Army and military generally faces yet another challenging recruiting environment. We have really kind of leaned into the idea of the warrior ethos. I think one of the Army's taglines over the last couple of years has been, you know, what's your warrior, right? Which we had conversations about a few months ago. And it faces a period of intense debate about identity and who joins, who is a member of the profession of arms, who counts to be a warrior, who gets to be a warrior. What are the important takeaways from your research in the 1990s that we should be on our minds today in 2024 as the Army deals with a new set of institutional challenges?
Great question. So I think the first thing is, and this goes back to the thing we just talked about, is drift, civil military drift is easier to cause than you think, right? I don't think anyone who set out to write the warrior ethos thought that they were going to help, you know, widen the divide between civilians and military. So that's something I would definitely want to bear in mind, given how wide that chasm already is. I think doing anything to widen it would be not a great idea to my mind, right? It doesn't seem like a very healthy thing to do. So that's the first thing. The second thing I think is if you look at the army of the 1990s in terms of like the geopolitical stuff, the force structure, the big decisions, like they didn't make decisions. And I don't think that served them well. I don't want to suggest the army goes crazy and gets rid of tanks or anything like that. But I do think that the army in the 1990s, they did go down, I think, the path of least resistance. And I'm not sure how well it served them in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly. And I don't know then that served them that well when they came back in years later to think about large scale conflict. So I guess it's very military sounding thing, but they make a decision. I think that is important, right? What the decision is, I'm agnostic on, but I do think it's important to choose, because once you know what that mission is, once you sort of have a sense of like, well, here's where we see the future, and here's the things we're willing to do, it makes those other decisions easier to make, I guess. But final thing, I suppose, is that, you know, what we've seen in Ukraine and obviously in Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else in the world, wars are long. They're very, very long. They are unpredictable. Everyone here at the War College would know that. But that what I'm getting at here is that you're not going to train a perfect force that's going to win the war in 3 days like they thought they did in Desert Storm, and it's all over, and you can go home for your big long parades. Like, I think if that was a bit of an aberration in many ways. So that means then you do need to have public buy-in and public support, which goes back to our Athenian-Spartan conversation, right? You have to have people willing to serve and willing to support that policy. So that's a challenge. Whatever war you're going to fight will be a very long war. It sounds very dismal note to end on, but it's important, right? And you will run out of warriors, perfect warriors, very quickly. So I think that's something to bear in mind, I think.
This about ends our time here, but if you would like to know more about the U.S. Army War College's Civil Military Relations Center and our programming, you can find us online at cmrc.armywarcollege.edu. I also want to thank you, Dr. Fitzgerald, for your time and insights into what is surely an interesting period in American civil-military relations, and also a period where everything old is new again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a great one.
And thanks to all of you for listening in to our series on modern civil-military relations. If you liked what you heard, please take a moment and subscribe to A Better Peace so that you don't have to miss an episode. And then rate the podcast on your podcatcher of choice so that we can grow our community. So until next time, I'm Carrie Lee from The War Room.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.